It will be our privilege at this hour to hear Brother R.L. Roberts, one of our colleagues here in the university, discuss the subject or make an exegesis of 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 through the first part of verse 17. Somebody asked me a while ago if he was related to J.W. Roberts, one of our faculty members who passed away a few years ago and who was an excellent Bible scholar. He is a brother to J.W., but R.L. is a scholar in his own right. He's serving as religious librarian and assistant professor of library science here at the university at the present time. He's been here now for about 12 years. He has a degree in the Master of Library Science, but he's done a great deal of graduate work in the Bible and biblical studies, Greek language, and so on. So he is a competent scholar. He is a preacher of the gospel. He has still preaches on occasion. He has served churches in Houston and one at Keller, Texas, in time past before he got into the library work. He taught Bible and church history at Fort Worth Christian College when that school was active. He's quite an excellent author, has written numerous topics for Restoration Quarterly and the Firm Foundation, 20th Century Christian, and other periodicals that we're acquainted with. He has done a great deal of work in our Brotherhood literature and is quite a scholar in Restoration periodicals, and he has done some editorial work in this. And he is the editor for an index of selected religious periodicals among us. He is a deacon in the university church here and a man who will have something definitely to say to us that'll be worthwhile. And so we're now glad to hear from Brother Roberts. There will be a question period following his presentation.
First Corinthians 7, 10 through 17 belongs to a section of the epistle that begins with chapter 6, 12 and continues to the close of chapter 7. In this section, Paul is dealing with a number of problems in the Corinthian church. Some of these problems were subjects of interrogation. Before answering the questions posed regarding the continuation of marriages of Christian partners and mixed marriages, Paul establishes the permanency of the marriage bond and relationship. And this principle is very significant in the consideration of this passage. Practical principles having been laid down, Paul now proceeds to apply these to special groups. First, to the unmarried, verse 8. Then to the married, three groups of married, the believers, married to unbelievers, verses 10 and 11. Second group, believers married to unbelievers who consent to remain, verses 12 and 13. And third, believers married to unbelievers who do not wish to continue such marriage, verses 15 and 16. Verse 10 says, to the married, I charge, not I, but the Lord, that the wife not be separated from her husband. The but is transitional, denoting that a new group is under consideration. The but is repeated throughout this section of the book as Paul discusses different groups. The group under discussion here and in verse 12 is different from those previous. In the latter, the mixed marriages, in verse 12, mixed marriages are under consideration. One of the partners is an unbeliever. So it seems clear that Paul is, in verse 10, discussing the marriages of Christian. Paul says, I charge, not I, but the Lord. He is not just passing on the order or stating a mere wish, as in verse 7. But he says that the Lord gives the command. Parangelo is used in classical Greek of military command. Groscheid, in discussing Paul's style here, quite appropriately says, twice Paul has spoken of what is good or commendable, to be pursued under certain circumstances only. But now a command is necessary to prevent the Corinthians from thinking that for a married person to remain together is only a good or a wish. Linsky states the exact sense of the verb when he says that the form of parangelo is that of the present tense, meaning that the order of Jesus has continuous permanent force. Paul says that the wife not separate from her husband. While the case of the woman seeking separation is mentioned first, it is difficult to assign a reason for this. Several have been mentioned as possibilities. First, Christianity had powerfully stirred the feminine mind at Corinth. Incompatibility or ascetic aversion may have caused the wish to separate. Robertson and Plummer suggest that beginning with the wife indicates that such separation had occurred, but also say that some women may have raised the question. Alfred thinks that the woman's part is brought out first because Christian women at Corinth may have been the most ready to make the separation. T.W. Chambers, in footnote to Meyer's commentary, says, the state of morals at Corinth is explanation enough, more especially in connection with the easy and frivolous way in which divorces took place in Greek social life generally. Not merely by dismissal on the part of the husband, but also by desertion on the part of the wife. Chambers notes that there is no sign of interrogation on this point, and thinks that Paul is simply disposing of the point in the even course of discussion regarding marriage and with a view of its completeness. Groscheid in the NIC series agrees that the fact that the Corinthian, that at Corinth as a woman might leave her husband as well as be dismissed by a husband is conclusive reason, and concludes that in any case Paul must forbid women in the name of Jesus to leave their husbands. He does not mean that he is here really conceding exceptions, but according to some, he is saying that the condition already exists. The law of Moses mentions no case of a wife divorcing her husband, but by this time Herodias had deserted her husband and Drusilla had deserted hers. And Josephus mentions Salome, the sister of Herod the Great, as the first Jewish to divorce her husband. Now, verse 12, but should she be separated, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to the husband, and that the husband not put away the wife. The thought, should she be separated, is parenthetical, the thought in this verse, the first part of the verse, and is disjoined from the command begun in verse 10 and concluded in the last part of verse 11. Though the parentheses is introduced by the day of antithesis, as in verse 28, this is not to be taken as granting a separation by way of exception, as if the preceding injunction were not to be understood in the strictest sense. The supposition is that of an actual case of a wife separating from her husband, or this will possibly arise in the future, notwithstanding the plain command of the Lord. It might be that the clause is introduced by Aeon Chi is concessive. In this case, the suggestion would be that there was such a case already in the church at Corinth, or at least it is likely to be realized. But it is more probable that the case may not yet actually have occurred. Burton says that Aeon Chi is the general manner of introducing a concessive clause, but he thinks Aeon in the Prodices as conditional and Chi as simply intensive, emphasizing the following word and suggesting the supposition that in some sense is extreme. The aorist subjunctive is timeless with respect to the context, the context supplying the occasion. Or the aorist is timeless with the context supplying the occasion. Robertson notes that the condition is a third-class conditional sentence, undetermined, and calls the verb put away ingressing. Linsky says that the condition is that of expectancy. It is clear that Paul is not stating an exception, but he's saying that even an extreme case must be viewed as being under the strict rule of Christ that a wife not be separated from her husband. Now Paul says, let her remain unmarried if she be separated. And here is an imperative, mineto. It is understood as applying to the woman as a resultant requirement, conditioned upon the fulfillment of the if clause, the Protestants. By this, she is not permitted to marry. Finley says her remaining unmarried is virtually included in the law of Christ, Matthew 5, 32, 19, and 9. Robertson and Plummer note that Christ had forbidden marriage with a divorced wife, Luke 16, 18, and contend that Paul here makes or takes the same ground. Alfred comments that Paul supposes action, separation, contrary, of course, to Christ's command, if such had already taken place, and the additional sin of new marriage must not be committed. Robertson justly observes that no allowance for remarriage of the innocent, as Jesus does, by implication, is here given. Groscheid concurs and says that the supposition cannot be an approval of divorce and views the action taken by the woman as illegitimate divorce and does not consider the marriage a null. This may be if there were some legal divorce such as we now know, but as Linsky points out, neither Jesus nor Paul discusses what we term divorce, namely legal court action. Both speak of what destroys a marriage. Paul said to be unmarried. The woman is to be unmarried. And she is unmarried as much so as those in verse 8 who had never been married. And with respect to any other, she must, other than her husband, she must remain so, or be reconciled to her husband. If she should decide that she could not and does not wish to remain unmarried, the only course open for her is to get herself reconciled, a passive verb, reconciled to her husband. Finley states that the verb, be reconciled, indicates the fact of alienation or dissension, but not on the side on which it exists. The reconciliation is to be initiated by the wife. The verb is secondary, passive imperative, and is ingressive, with stress on the beginning of the action of which the woman is the subject. The case of the husband is dative of personal interest. And Paul says, let not the husband put her away. Put away is an indirect command, as is to be separated following I charge. Paul used a different term from the one used of the wife in verse 10. The change is understandable when we see that the wife could not send away the husband since the house was his. She could only separate herself by leaving, while he could divorce her by sending her away. Koristhenai, the verb which means to send away, is used in the Septuagint frequently in the sense of the separation in place. This was especially in accord with Jewish custom. While that of the woman leaving the husband is frequent in Greco-Roman custom, Paul uses a phenai, put away or send away, just as Jesus uses apoluo in Mark 10, 11, and 12. He uses this word both of the husband in verse 11 and the wife in verse 13. Both mean the same thing. Divorce or send away. So Paul makes the woman and the man equal here. Paul is here stating the rule, not the exception. We do not infer that he does not know or allow fornication as an exception, as does Christ in Matthew 19. Having already established that fornication breaks the marriage relationship as well as one's relationship to Christ, he proceeds with this fact understood as a matter of course. As Myers says, the validity of this ground of divorce is self-evident. All this fits the context of this section of the book, from 6:12 to 7:40, in which Paul establishes first the indissolvability of marriage, and second also the immediate context where the absolute strictness of the command of Christ regarding marriage is applied to Christians married to each other. A note on charizo or charizo, which means to separate or divorce. It is used four times in this context with reference to the marriage relationship. It is also used by the Lord in the statement, "What God has joined together, let not man put asunder." This word is formed by the use of the adverbial preposition, chloris, separate, apart, be by itself, which became the verb stem to which is added the suffix iso or idzo. The verb is intensive or iterative. That is, it expresses the idea of separation more intensely than does the adverb. Originally, the verb seems to have been used as a reference to mere separation or division of any sort. But by the 4th century B.C., it had become, or had come to be used of marriage relationship, or separation, and divorce. The Greek authors used the word in the sense of divorce. Hart and Gingrich state that charizo is found often in marriage contracts in the papyri, and cites one reference of this use in the 2nd century B.C., where three references to 1st century B.C. papyri where the same use occurs. Based on these uses, their claim is that the passive or middle form means, quote, separation or separate oneself, be separate, of divorce, and conclude that Paul's use of the same word in 1 Corinthians 7 is that of indicating absolute separation in divorce. Moulton and Milligan say that the word has almost become a technical term in connection with divorce in the papyri as in 1 Corinthians 7. Adolf Deichmann says of the verb that it was used in the Fayum papyri as in 1 Corinthians 7 as a technical expression for divorce. He further says that in marriage contracts there are usually conditions for the possibility of separation, and these are introduced with the formula using the verb that Paul uses here. But if the marriage separate one from another. There is little doubt that the word as used by Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 refers to the separation of divorce. It is not just separation in bed and board, but of the dissolution of the marriage bond. Verse 12, Paul says, "But to the rest say I, not the Lord. If a brother has an unbelieving wife, and she consents to dwell with him, let him not put her away." Paul's use of the expression, "to the rest," shows that he is dealing with the circumstance of mixed marriages. This is clear from no more than a casual reading of the text and needs not be discussed. The use of the expression, "the rest," to refer to those not included in the Christian fellowship is found in the New Testament in a number of places. This argues strongly for the idea that at the time of their marriage, neither the husband nor the wife was a Christian, but that one of the partners afterwards was converted. So a new problem, not existing in Jesus' day, is now in view. That is, should the marriage of a believer and an unbeliever continue? Paul says, "I say, not the Lord." The meaning is that Paul is not quoting the Lord. He is not disclaiming inspiration. He distinguishes between the absolute valid command of the Lord and his own exposition of it. Paul says, "If a brother has an unbelieving wife," the verb has the sense of "has" and not "keeps" or "retains." This is also the sense of verse 2. On the force of the conditional clause here, Groscheid explains that the first part of the conditional sentence shows that there were Christians at Corinth who thought that they were permitted or even obligated to divorce their wives when the latter refused to abjure their paganism. But Paul points out the necessity for a distinction here. There is one condition which, if fulfilled, renders divorce not only unnecessary, but even forbidden. Paul is not speaking of an unfaithful wife, although apistos sometimes may have this sense. Paul is talking about mixed marriages, And his mixed marriage is not to be taken as a ground per se for divorce. Paul now gives the reason why this is true. That is, she, the unbeliever, consents to dwell with him. Consent is from a compound word which means mutual consent, implying that more than one person is satisfied. It is often used with the dative of the thing in which agreement is found. So Paul is saying that both partners agree to live together in marriage. In such case, he says, let him not put her away. Paul is speaking of divorce, which is here forbidden as before. The Revised Version has leave here and in verse 13. But put away is better, as in both cases the idea is that of divorce. The Revised Standard Version so translates, he should not divorce her. Apheto equals the same sense of poluein in Mark 10 and 11. Now the woman, verse 13, and a woman who has an unbelieving husband and he consents to dwell with her, let her not put him away. The wording of this verse is much like that of verse 12. These differences occur. The wife is now the subject. Paul says the same thing with respect to the wife not divorcing her partner when he consents to continuing the marriage. Why does Paul repeat this rule with respect to the wife? Two possibilities may be suggested. First, Paul is giving the woman a place of honor. And second, the Christian wife would have to send away her husband if the unbeliever consents to dwell. This would be a presumptuous violation of duty. And two, whereas a conditional clause is found in verse 12, a relative clause is now used, and its force is that of referring to a definite and actual event or fact. Paul is not giving woman the right to rule the man. This is opposed to Genesis 3:16 and many New Testament passages. To put away is used of the wife, while it is commonly used only of the husband. This shows that both have the same liberty and responsibility regarding Christian behavior in such mixed marriages. The translation of apheto in verses 12 and 13. The King James fails to denote the identity of the term in both verses. It is put away in verse 12 and leave in verse 13. The American Standard Version has leave in both verses. But this does not give full identity. The Revised Standard Version is quite exact with he or she should not divorce him or her. The New English Bible is stronger. Must not divorce. Though Paul is no more sanctioning Christians marrying non-believers than Ezra would permit Jews and Gentiles marrying. But Paul did not call for the dissolution of such marriages. Verse 14 says, for the unbelieving husband is sanctified in the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified in the brother. Else then your children are unclean, but now are they holy. The language of this verse is evidently meant to obviate any objection that Christians might feel toward continuing a union with an unbeliever. Paul's warning, as in 2 Corinthians 6:14, would certainly tend to create such a feeling. Also, it might have been felt that a Christian would become defiled by intercourse with a heathen. This due to Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians 6:15. Whether such a protest was actual does not appear. But that it is likely appears certain. And now Paul replies, the unbelieving is sanctified. Finley comments that this replies a paradox and does not affirm conversion, rather, or whether it is incipient or prospective, but rather is referring to a relationship established for the non-Christian in the past. This is the sense of the perfect tense used here. The sanctification of the unbeliever has its basis in the person of the believer. Note the in both cases. The Christian partner is the sphere in which the sanctity takes place. The footnote of Chambers in Myers is most interesting and to the point here. In a mixed marriage, the Christian hagiotos forms in relation to the non-Christian unholiness. The holiness of the Christian forms in relation to the unholiness of the non-Christian, the preponderating element. Observe how, in a totally different way, Paul regards the relation of a Christian who has connected himself with a harlot in 6 and 15. In that case, the harlot is the preponderating element, and the members of Christ become unholy members of a harlot. The force of Paul's language is clearly that the union, though mixed, is not unholy due to the holiness of one of the partners. So the marriage is not impure or unlawful, and the principle of one flesh holds good even in such a union. The unlawful union with a harlot, by contrast, desecrates the believer. Now Paul says, "Else then, your children are unclean." Else then is an elliptical clause meaning, since in such a case, that is, as understood, an alternate, a non-hallowing case, in such a case, Paul says, your children would be unclean. He is not declaring the alternative as true when he uses the present tense. The supposed case is assumed, and the present tense indicates only that it is something that has place in assumption. If what is assumed in the conditional clause is true, then what is stated in the coordinate clause is also true. Your children are unclean. But Paul says this is not true, as he affirms it very emphatically. He affirms their holiness. But now are they holy. This is axiomatic. It proves the sanctity of the marriage. If the sanctity does not hold good, the children are unclean. But they're not unclean, Paul says. Paul argues from the holiness of the children back to the sanctity of the marriage. This part of the verse has come into play often in controversy over infant baptism. Some think that it argues for and definitely establishes the practice in the first century. The basis for saying that the children are holy is a difficult thing to establish with certainty. Chambers thinks that it does not lie in the fact of their being born or begotten of Christian parents. This may be true, since he says some of the children may have been born before either parent embraced Christianity. But this should not be thought to infer that the children of non-Christian parents are unclean. Neither should they be thought to be as holy in the sense of the children mentioned here who have a relationship with one who is holy. Children out of the sort of union mentioned in 6:15 with a harlot are unclean. It may be that Paul is now showing that the children of mixed marriage are not unclean. The holiness of the children seems to be analogous to the sanctity of the unbelieving partner, according to Finley's view. Alfred agrees with this view and comes to what is probably the real basis of the holiness in this comment. The holiness is not personal holiness, which is here predicated of the children, any more than the unbelieving wife or husband has holiness of dedication, except by the strict dependence on one dedicated. The holiness of the children, having this basis, does not depend on another basis, that is, baptism or the new birth. The sanctity of the unbeliever certainly could not rest on anything else, nor have as its basis the new birth, because these are definitely conditioned upon faith. If the unbeliever should be converted, then his sanctity or holiness would not be due to the marriage relationship, but in his own person. The holiness of the children in this state must include a time in their life when it is yet inconceivable that they have faith or exercise faith. Since the uncleanness would be removed by the new birth and holiness would follow, another basis for holiness, not mentioned and not in Paul's view, would be evident. Myers makes the case for this point very clear when he shows that Paul's language argues against the practice of infant baptism at this time. Had the baptism of Christian children been then in existence, Paul could not have drawn this inference. The inference, else then were your children unclean. Because in that case, the holiness of such children would have another basis. Robertson and Plummer agree that Paul is not assuming that the child of a Christian parent would be baptized. This would spoil rather than help his argument, for it would imply that the child has holiness, does not have holiness until it was baptized. And this verse throws no light on the question of infant baptism. Verse 15, but if the unbeliever separates himself, let him be separated. The brother or the sister is not under bondage in such cases. But God has called us in peace. But if the unbeliever separate himself, here Paul uses the present tense, middle, to indicate a state of mind of the unbeliever. The force of the present tense shows that the heathen partner wishes to disassociate himself from the believer. The act of separating himself or herself is entirely the act of the unbeliever. And is seen, and this is seen from the fact that ho apistos is in emphatic position. The unbeliever, this is in emphatic position. Alfred says, if the wish for separation, applied in the present tense, is for being separated, then he says, proceed from the side of the unbeliever, emphasis on ho apistos. Let him or her depart, be separated off. Nothing said indicates that the Christian partner is to take the initiative in seeking the divorce.
Please run this cassette fast forward to the end and turn it over for side two.
Now, let him be separated. And here's chorizo again. Paul now says that the Christian may let the unbeliever depart since he does not consent to dwell, using the present imperative middle for expressing permission, not a command. Paul refers to the liberty granted to the believer. He permits the unbeliever to separate or to divorce. Groshid states the matter plainly by noting that when the unbeliever departs, if the believing party were under obligation to prevent the departure, he would be subject to the unbeliever and would virtually be forced to abandon his or her faith, since only by doing that could the divorce be prevented. That price would be too high. If, therefore, circumstances are as Paul describes them, the Christian shall resign himself to the divorce. Now, Paul says the brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. Ho de doulotai is not under bondage. It's closely connected with the permissive imperative, let him be departed. Since the Christian is told to acquiesce, the liberty to do so is further explained by is not under bondage. De doulotai is the passive, perfect passive indicative of doulo, which means to enslave, and with the negative literally means does not remain a slave. This is the perfect of existing condition, indicating that the party has been enslaved. Kittle's Theological Dictionary of the New Testament says that doulo is used literally and or figurative to denote absolute subjection or loss of autonomy. And that in 1 Corinthians 7:15 expresses total binding by another. The apostle speaks to the situation of the believer attempting to prevent a divorce when the unbeliever wishes to depart, not understanding that the unbeliever may be permitted to depart. Such a situation possibly existed at Corinth. This is implied in the text. Paul is probably answering a question regarding such a case. Robertson and Plumber say that not under bondage indicates that the Christian partner is under no slavish obligation to refuse to be set free. In such matters, the Christian not under bondage has not lost all freedom of action, that is. Paul disabuses the Christian partner who might believe himself or herself obligated to maintain cohabitation at all costs. Now, a reason for the permissive imperative. God has called us in peace, but God has called us in peace. Robertson and Plummer think that this clause forces the above interpretation. They ask, to what is peace opposed? To them it seems natural to understand that it is opposed to bondage. Then the meaning will be that to feel bound to remain to one who objects would violate the peace in which Paul says we are permanently called. If peace is opposed to divorce, then the meaning will be that you ought to do your utmost to avoid divorce. There are some who think that this passage does not allow divorce at all. And we'll get to that a little later. To them, the former is right. The day is the positive complement of the negative oo. Some observations. Greek and Roman law offered great facilities for divorce, especially for the husband. Roman law allowed the husband full disposal of the wife for almost any reason. But here Paul is not permitting such action on the part of a believer in any case. No word indicates that a Christian might divorce a spouse. Let it be clearly understood that this action is not the action of the believer, but the unbeliever. It is argued that the fact that Paul uses douloo, an intense verb, here, while in other places uses a milder word, deo, to refer to the marriage bond, Romans 7:2, 1 Corinthians 7:39, this indicates that surely the marriage bond is broken and that the unbeliever is permitted, or that the believer is permitted to remarry. Remarriage is not in the scope of Paul's language here. The stronger verb in the passage implies that for the repudiated party to continue bound to the repudiator would be slavery. Not under bondage does not appear to equal free to marry. If Paul had been wanting to express such an idea, he could easily have used a more natural expression such as found in verse 39 of the same chapter. Free to be married. He had a word for it. The verse is silent concerning remarriage. No discussion is made regarding guilt or innocence in the state or in the case of remarriage. Finley says, whether the freedom of the innocent divorced extends to remarriage does not appear. Robertson states that Luther argued for remarriage, then adds, but that is by no means clear unless the unbeliever marries first. So also Robertson and Plummer. We cannot safely agree with Luther that not under bondage implies that the Christian partner, when divorced by the heathen partner, may marry again. The absence of a clear, unambiguous statement concerning remarriage strongly indicates that no question on this subject had been posed. If the matter of contracting a new marriage had been the subject of inquiry, we believe that Paul would have made full response and not have left the matter to be decided on mere implication. The historical context is opposed to an exegesis that would see verse 15 as an authorization for the Christian entering into a new marriage contract. Considering the distress of verse 26, the shortened time of verse 29, Paul declares that to be unmarried is good, verse 8. He suggests that with continence that the husband and wife might with consent be separated for prayer for a season, verse 5, and advises that the unmarried remain so for their own profit, verse 35. The unity and the cohesion of the context is clear when we see verse 15 as allowing only the minimum of change. When Paul is advocating celibacy, does he also advocate remarriage? Verse 16, for what do you know, O wife, whether you shall save your husband? Or what do you know, O husband, whether you shall save your wife? The two questions that form this verse are very curiously ambiguous. They may be taken, if viewed separately, either as reasons for or against divorce. The syntax allows either interpretation, seemingly. The difficulty is that of determining the force of T oidas. What do you know? Followed by the A of whether. This construction can refer to a matter about which there is hope. In this case, it would be against divorce, in hope of saving the unbeliever, though he may be for separating. It is also a form of expressing doubt, in which case it would be understood as being for divorce because doubt exists regarding the remoteness of saving an unbeliever. when he wants to be separated. If it is for divorce, it is only for it under the circumstances of verse 15. The case for viewing verse 16 as against divorce forces this translation. For how do you know, O wife or husband, that you shall not, and the not supplied, you shall not save your husband or wife? Or as William Barclay translates, remember that as a wife, for all you know, you may very well be the means of saving your husband. Now this takes verse 16 as being opposed to divorce under the circumstances mentioned earlier, even. One device for establishing this interpretation is to view verse 15 as wholly parenthetical. Finley feels that those who hold for the interpretation as being for divorce are reading between the lines. He reasons, his reason for thinking this, as opposed to divorce, is this. It should also be observed that the Corinthians, with lax moral notions, need dissuasives rather than encouragement to divorce. On the other hand, that to discountenance the hope of a soul's salvation is strangely unlike the apostle. Chapter 10, verse 33. On the construction here adopted, Paul returns to the close of the section, to the thought with which it began. Let him not be divorced. What do you know? And whether together are used in the Septuagint as an expression of hope. Lightfoot cites four places in the Septuagint. Esther 4:14, Joel 2:14, Jonah 3:9, 2 Samuel 12:22, where there are expressions of hope introduced with these words or by these words. He prefers the interpretation that a chance of saving is worth any temporal inconvenience. Objections to this view that it is against divorce. To view first verse 15 is altogether parenthetical is harsh as regards the context. Myers very justly says that though some make 16 to be the concluding confirmation of the whole admonition that begins with the expression to the rest in verse 12, this is impossible for this reason. That the first part of the counsel given to the rest has already received its confirmation in the for or gar of verse 14. And in accordance wherewith, the gar of verse 16 must now refer in the way of confirmation only to the second part of the said counsel as confirmation in verse 15. Alford objects to the view and says that those who interpret as against divorce take a me for a, though this is hardly grammatically permissible. Paul is not saying, what knowest thou whether thou shalt not save? Alford also says that each of the passages cited in the Septuagint to show that what knowest thou is an expression of hope is a different expression, in that in them the verb stands in an emphatic position. He claims that the same expression is also found in the Septuagint simply to express uncertainty and doubt. And he says the position of the verb is important. Alfred says, if the point of the argument had been in 1 Corinthians 7, if the point of the argument had been the importance or the prospect of saving the unbelieving party, the arrangement would have been different. The verb holds in both clauses a subordinate place rather than subjective to the person addressed. It is not the main object in the mind of the writer. Now, the case for viewing verse 16 is for divorce, the questions as being for divorce. There is little or no point in trying to avoid the fact that Paul is speaking of divorce in verse 15. There is no reason for putting parentheses around it. Paul is definitely speaking of the actual divorce, and on a limited exception. The Christians at Corinth might very naturally have had conscientious scruples against divorce, even in such cases. They would try to prevent it on grounds that all hope of saving the unbeliever would be lost. What Paul says shows that he evidently did not deem this sufficient ground. Marriage as a means of conversion is of real significance, but freedom and peace are of greater importance. Grosseteste says that this appears from the fact that the question introduced by "for how" follows after the legitimacy of divorce has been argued first. This is in exact accord with the whole context. Grosseteste further says that verse 16 is not a reason for the two latter parts of verse 15, not under bondage, and God has called us to peace. It is rather an additional reason for the statement in 15a, let him depart. The questions cohere with the words immediately preceding, that is 15b, and thus the strict sense of all of verse 15 is preserved. God has called us in peace, and just here, this peace is only possible through separation. This view of the verse suits the context best and is adopted by most commentators. Yet Robertson points out, one hesitates to interpret Paul as advocating divorce unless strongly insisted on by the unbeliever. There is no problem at all unless the unbeliever makes it. If it is a hopeless case, acquiescence is the only wise solution. But surely the believer ought to be sure that there is no hope before he agrees to break the bond. With Stanley, we conclude this interpretation is the only one compatible with the obvious sense of verse 15, is also in exact harmony with the general tenor of the apostle's argument, which is not to urge a union, but to tolerate a separation. Verse 17a, only as the Lord has distributed to each, as God hath called each, so let him walk. And thus I order in all the churches. No detailed exegesis of this verse is planned. However, we should note briefly its relation to the argument of the preceding verses. The question has been raised by Alfred and Ellicott whether Paul is summarizing in verse 17 or making a fresh start. Robertson and Plummer say that there is no close connection between verse 18 and verse 17. What connection there is can be seen from the accepted sense of the first two words, a me, meaning only or save only or except that. And they introduce a caution regarding the preceding instruction. It also forms an introduction to the or preface to what follows. Paul has already, in verses 12 and 14, prohibited the Christian partner from divorcing an unbelieving spouse when such a one consents to dwell with a Christian partner. But after the statements regarding a situation in which the unbeliever is for divorcing, Paul says that a Christian may permit the divorce, avoid slavery, as doubt of saving the companion is so certain that to continue in the union would not guarantee it. He now warns that the Christian is not to make this the ground for causing separation. In verse 17, Paul is stating a general rule, and under this general rule, the exceptional and guarded permission of divorce in verse 15 must be understood. This principle extends to every situation in life, as Paul proceeds to show in the verses following. Conclusions. Number one, Paul establishes the indissolvability of marriage, even mixed marriages, resulting from one partner becoming a Christian. Number two, the Christian partner is never to take the initiative in seeking a divorce. On the other hand, number three, the Christian partner is at liberty to accept acquiescently the action of an unbelieving partner who is for divorcing. The Christian thus avoids absolute servitude. And four, both the literary and historical context of 1 Corinthians 7 is opposed to seeing verse 15 as a Pauline authorization to entering a new marriage.
Thank you very much, Brother Roberts. We're going to have about 10 minutes here for questions according to the clock. And we have a roving microphone. Kenny, where are you? Stand up here. We'll get some on the north side first, and then you'll move over and get some on the south side. Your questions should be addressed to Brother Roberts, and preferably to something he has said. here, in other words, relative to the topic at hand. You are, please, asked not to make a speech about some idea you have or theory, because we've only got 10 minutes. We want to use this to best advantage. So now, would you hold up your hands, please, right here. Just a moment, use the mic. Take the mic and point it right at your mouth and hold it up within about an inch and a half.
Okay. I'm Jack Love from Jal, New Mexico. Brother Roberts, I'd like to ask you a question on the 15th verse. Not under bondage. She is loosed. She is free. Now, I'm going back to Romans 7, where Paul talks about a married situation there. And he infers the same, it seems to me, that... In Romans 7, of course, if she is loosed or if she is free, then she has the right to remarry. The inference in Romans, or in 1 Corinthians 7, then in 15, is that she is not under bondage. Would you explain the likeness between bondage, being free, as you said, as a set free as a slave, and then being loosed over in Romans 7?
When I was in school, I had a fellow that lived across the hall in the dorm from me who had a class under Brother Bell in the Thessalonian epistles. And when he took the final examination for that class, he asked Brother Bell if he could keep a copy of the questions. He said when he got to heaven, he was going to ask Paul and see if he could answer. I told somebody about this the other day, and they said, well, some people won't even take what Paul said. Well, you have the weak verb, the weaker verb in Romans 7, deo, or duo, whichever it is. And doulao is the intense word in 1 Corinthians 7. Now, Paul is saying, Paul uses one verb, the verb that is a permissive imperative. And this is the only action of which the believer is the subject. You can permit him to be separated, a permissive imperative. This is not a command. It doesn't come across as a command. It's like Matthew 26:45. Jesus was telling the disciples, watch now, watch. You know, after the third time he came and he found them sleeping, and he says, sleep on now and take your rest. And he explains why they have this permission. Why this permissive imperative? The people who would betray the Son of Man are at the gate. The hour has come. See, he's explaining to them their liberty of sleeping. Okay, this is the relationship of the thing. Now, Paul uses the strong word in 1 Corinthians 7 to say that the Christian can act in this one action. You can consent. You can acquiesce. If you cannot, you are an absolute slave. You cannot act in any way. You're totally subject to that man because of religion, and God didn't call you for that. Well, that's all he's saying. He's not explaining a condition of general loosing. He is saying your liberty includes the acquiescing, this action, and that's the only verb I see that he uses where the believer is the subject of the action. And this makes it, if you can't allow this, then you're a total slave. Any other?
Okay. Let's get one right over here then.
Bill Barksdale from Bakersfield, California. I'd like to have you comment, Brother Roberts, on verse 8. I know this wasn't included in your exegesis, but with this principle, to the unmarried and to the widows, I say to them, it is well for them to remain single as I do, but if they can't exercise self-control, they should marry. Would this apply to those that are freed under what you've talked about here, the unbeliever leaving his wife? and she's free, would that principle apply to her? Because she would be unmarried. She would be of the unmarried state. Would you come in on that, please?
I think that Paul is not really concerned with describing the state of the person thus separated. He does say that the bond is broken. I agree to that. But he does not describe anything or say anything with regard to what state either of them is in. A long time ago, I sat in Brother Robertson's classes, and he emphasized to us over and over and over that Paul does not say one word about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And I've never found him wrong in that.
Okay.
I think, really, let me add a little bit to that. I think in verse 8, Paul is talking about maybe three cases where a person is unmarried, where a person is a widow, and where a person has been married and is no longer living with the spouse. An article came out recently claiming that this was Paul's case, that Paul was married, that he had a wife who would not go with him because she was not a Christian, and that he is actually in verse 15 and 16 talking about himself. Jeremias teaches this same idea, that Paul was a married individual, and that he may be here referring to himself. And this is just as easily proved as proving that he was a bachelor. Another question?
I'm Roy Smalling from Colorado Springs, and you mentioned in verse 15 and 16 that Paul had no reference to remarriage, and you said a moment ago that he never does. I'm wondering, in verse 11, he tells the Christian wife she's to remain married to her husband, but if she won't do it, she is to remain single or else be reconciled. Doesn't this indicate that, number one, she could divorce him, but if she did, she had to remain single the rest of her life? And would this not relate
to... Not to.
What's
He's
that?
Saying there for her not to divorce him.
But in verse 11, it says, but if she does...
Respect to another, she has to remain unmarried, but not... She has to go back to her husband. With respect to any other, she must remain agamos.
If she has divorced him, then she has done what you said he can't do.
He says not to divorce. If she does, he's not assuming that she has already, that's already happened. But with respect to any other, she is to remain unmarried.
We have time for one more.
Please, sir.
Joe Schubert from Houston. Would the fact that the question was raised in verse 12 infer anything at all about whether Christians in the first century contracted marriages after they became Christians with people who were not Christians? Do you understand the question?
Well, I don't really know. That's one you'd have to ask Paul about. I don't really know how you could decide that. I don't see any. And Paul is very strongly, it seems to me, stating that a Christian should not be yoked with an unbeliever and is enter into it. This is an unequal thing. It's like hooking up an ass and an ox.
We appreciate this very much, Brother Roberts. Frankly, this is a thing we'll all be pondering for a while. If you have a burning question, I'm sure Brother Roberts would be glad to talk to you individually. However, I'm not trying to stick a whole bunch of folks on to you, R.L. But the thing is, we appreciate this study and appreciate the materials that he's gone into it. And you can tell that he has been through the scholarly techniques with the way he has handled the language. And we're grateful to him for that. Remember the programs for the rest of the day, and to be back in here for the Bama Road presentation tonight, if you possibly can. Would you bow with me? Our Father, we're grateful for the interest that we have in thy word. for arranging our lives in such a way that we will be in perfect conformity to thy will. Help us, Father, as students of thy word and as teachers of thy word, that we may come into a true and meaningful understanding for our lives and for those whom we teach. Forgive our sins, keep us in the hollow of thy hand, and save us through Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.